Hey folks, welcome to the Safe Space podcast. We're here with Michaela Loach, and today we are chatting all about climate activism and how queer people can get involved.
Great. I recently did a podcast with someone where they took, I'm not even exaggerating, probably like 20 minutes to record the one line intro, and I was just sitting there like...
Doesn't play with confidence, does it?
I was like...
Doesn't play with confidence. We're a bit stumbly.
Yeah,
Emma's quite dyslexic,
no,
and I think I am too.
No, I am as well, so don't worry.
Okay.
This is very... I think we're going to have a chill chat, which will be quite nice.
Amazing. Do you want to hit with the first question there, Hess?
No, I think you should do the first question.
Okay. 1 second, it'll take me 20 minutes. I'll do this.
So who are you? What are your pronouns and what do you do?
My name is Michaela Loach. I use she, they pronouns, and I'm a climate justice organiser and author of a book called It's Not That Radical, which still feels exciting to say because it's very recent. And doing lots of things, but I'm just trying to focus on how can we tackle the climate crisis in a way that actually transforms the world and makes it a better place rather than just kind of continuing the world as it is now, which I think is what we've often been sold as the best that we can get, which is not that right.
Well. Yeah. So, Michaela, how did your journey with activism begin?
I recently gave a talk at a primary school, and that kind of forced me to go through a bit more of my journey and made me feel a little bit less imposter syndrome-y, because I think sometimes that imposter syndrome comes from us just forgetting how we got there in the first place. Mm-hmm. And when I was talking to the kids, I started off with, like, when I was 5 years old and did like a bake sale as the first kind of active thing I did, because I saw, at the time it was when the Boxing Day tsunami had happened, and I saw it on the news and I was really cared about it. Mm-hmm. And my parents just said, oh, if you care about this, like, what do you think you can do about it right now? I think that's a question that I've then asked myself all the way through my life. When I've seen something happening that I'm like upset or angry about, it's like, what can I do about it? You don't have to just be angry and sad in the face of the things that happen around us. We can actually do something. Mm-hmm. And then I think, yeah, getting much older, I think at school we're often taught that, like, all the changes that happen throughout history were just done by these exceptional individuals, and liberation has been fought and won, so we just need to be grateful and that everything is kind of done as it is now. But I could see that wasn't true. And then learning from my parents a lot about Nanny the Maroons and freedom fighters in Jamaica really showed me that liberation isn't something that's handed down from above. It's something that's fought up from the ground up. And so again, when I saw something else in the news that made me feel quite like upset, which was a picture of the body of Alan Kurdi. I don't know if people remember that, but a 3-year-old Syrian boy's body washed up on a beach in Greece. And I was about 2.5 when my family moved to the UK from Jamaica. And so a very similar age to Alan was when he died, trying to make a very similar journey. And I think that seeing that photograph and realising how paralleled, I guess, our experience were in very different ways. I wasn't fleeing conflict, but I was able to move safely and easily just because of privilege of having a British passport and having a British father. And that same privilege and ease wasn't offered to Alan or his family. Mm-hmm. That kind of really humanised, I think, the what was called the refugee crisis at the time. And so I went to Calais and started organising on the border with the UK and France and trying to support what was then called the jungle, the refugee camp there. So that was doing very basic things of like folding clothes and chopping vegetables. But there I saw people who were so ordinary, but so wonderful at the same time. And I realised that activism doesn't have to be this huge, like, incredible thing that exceptional individuals do. It can be something really, really small, and just means being active in the face of an issue. And so from there I ended up caring a lot about the climate crisis and realizing that that's going to make every other issue I care about much greater, and got involved with direct action, like chain of command things on the street. Then taking the government to court around fossil fuel subsidies, and since then trying to kind of tackle the fossil fuel industry from like a communications perspective, but also from like an actions perspective, and then now trying to kind of form all those comms understandings into the book that I've written. Mm.
Yeah, how old were you when you took the government to court?
I think I was 22.
Wow.
At the time. But it was I was the youngest claimant, and the other two claimants were Jeremy and Karen, and they were much, much older than I am. Mm-hmm. I actually don't know their ages, so I don't want to, so I get them wrong. That was kind of following on from, about a year and a half before that, I'd been involved with Extinction Rebellion Scotland, which had different politics to Extinction Rebellion as a whole, and we occupied outside of Westminster Abbey, so where the Department for Business, Energy, Industrial Strategy, which basically was the department that both like was meant to be tackling the climate crisis and was also meant to be, well, was giving huge amounts of money to the fossil fuel industry, public money. And so our kind of occupation of that road was to disrupt their actions and to try and bring awareness of the fact that billions of our public money is being paid to these multi-billion pound fossil fuel companies, which is absolutely wild. And it promotes them in polluting. And so to kind of, I guess, putting myself in a restable position in those actions felt like a last resort tactic. But then still not enough change happened from there. And then we decided that, I mean, another last resort tactic is litigation. And so we decided to take the government to court to try and both challenge that policy legally, but also to bring more awareness about it. Because people didn't really know that loads of our money is going to fossil fuel companies, for, like public money that could be being used for hospitals or schools or things that actually are good for public good. It's kind of wild.
It's all being flitted away somewhere, isn't it? But where? That I remember that, this is not going to go in the podcast, but I remember meeting some people from XR Scotland outside of Westminster Abbey. Because I was like photographing and I fell over a tent thing. Mm-hmm. There was tents there, right? Mm-hmm. And I fell in, and then I saw this guy that I'd met years ago in Germany. And I was like, Wonka? And then he was like, Hester. And I was like, what the fuck are you doing here? And then like, we spoke for a bit and then they were like, oh, we've got to go and run off and we've got to chain ourselves to something. And I was like, okay.
I mean, was that in 2019? Do you know?
I think it must have been.
Yeah, I might have been running around there in a pink jumpsuit trying to do
was
loads
it a
of stuff.
Poofy jumpsuit?
Yeah, it was. Maybe it's very possible. It was like black. It was a ski suit because it was October, so it was freezing. And I had a tiny pop-up tent that I bought for £10 on eBay.
You know a guy called Wung?
Yes, Wung is one of my close friends in German.
I've met you then. Yeah, because I fell over into Wung's tent.
Well, my tent was next to Wung's, I think. That's wild.
That is wild. And you were like, I'm going to go, like...
That was the moment when I think I decided, because I didn't go there expecting to, like... Because I was really
that is
not...
spooky.
That's weird.
That is spooky. I've got, like, pictures, like, on my camera somewhere from that, like...
Somewhere in the corner.
As soon as you said that, I was like... Because then your face started to look a bit familiar. It was
all...
Just then.
All coming together.
Like, wow. That's
yeah,
incredible.
Yeah, that's very wild. And here we are today. You know,
nice
all
to
coming
you again.
Together. Now you've got to keep it in.
You also reminded me, because when you said the thing about the tsunami, I remember being a little kid and going like mad about the tsunami and going to wash cars on the street. And I think I made like 20 quid.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that... I think I also did something similar when I was... I think I also washed the cars of my neighbours at the same time as well. Very parallel lives. Yeah. That's so bizarre. Gosh, what a small world.
It's weird.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's that.
I'm now remembering this moment as well. I think you did... I remember... I think you did look after my tent.
Because you had your bags in it.
Yes. Gosh. We're having
that's
a moment.
So strange.
That is weird.
That's one of those weird things.
Yes,
simulations.
Really?
Yeah. Like we were talking about One Tree Hill the other day for about a good old 3 hours.
Because I love One Tree Hill.
And this particular woman in it. And then she followed us.
Yeah.
God, did you drop her a message?
We started communicating with her through video. We're like, and this is Peyton Sawyer from One Tree Hill. I love her. She likes it.
She does. She loves it.
We wanted to ask, what is an activist? Like, what's an activist to you? What does it mean?
I literally just think it means being active in the face of an issue that you care about or something in this world. I think that often people think, to be an activist, you have to be this incredible person or a public speaker or the person protesting on the streets. But some of the, like, activists I know who do such important work, it's filling out spreadsheets and writing Google Docs and doing lots of very invisibilized work that is still so important. But I think a lot of people feel like they can't be an activist because they don't want to do the public-facing stuff. But I think that everyone can be an activist in their own way. And there are those people who are already doing activism who might not realise it because it doesn't seem like the brand that you see normally in the media.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of this. I read this thing about Rosa Parks and, like, before the bus boycotts, there was these, like, overnight women would be, like, writing leaflets, printing leaflets, cutting leaflets all night. So the bus boycotts could happen, but we remember Rosa Parks.
Yeah.
Not that we shouldn't remember Rosa Parks, but, like, there were so many individuals that
were
necessary for that.
And I think even, like, obviously Rosa Parks was incredible, and as were, like, so many of the individuals' names that we know. But I do think there's, like, a really, like, real kind of function of us just focusing on the individuals and and forgetting all the people who printed the leaflets, who without whom this stuff wouldn't have happened as well. Even the fact that, like, with Dr. King, he was chosen by like 5 or 6 black women to like be the charismatic leader that they needed. Mm-hmm. That work was already happening for a long time. But it's I think has a very real function of like, oh, if we think it's just the incredible people, then that means that also not only do we not think we can have a role, but also we can feel like, oh, we have to wait for someone who's incredible to come along, or we feel like, oh, we can leave all the work to these like incredible public figures or something. But actually, there's so much that we can all do in our own ways as well.
In the book, you mentioned that your journey through activism started somewhat in Calais.
Mm-hmm.
I also spent some time in Calais.
No way!
a few years ago. And this part of the book really kind of stuck out to me, so I'm going to read it. In Calais, I met real-life activists who, whilst obviously selfless, wonderful and inspiring, were just normal people. They had seen an issue and decided to do something about it. They weren't perfect, they were just seemingly ordinary people who had done extraordinary things. It became clear to me that that was all it took to be an activist. Just be active.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of moved on to this thing about movements are made up of many different people with many different roles coming together in order to create change. We need everyone to be an activist against the system of oppression. We need everyone to join movements for change. We need everyone to be an activist in the fight for climate justice. And that includes you. So why are we told that change just comes from heroes? Who does this narrative serve? I wanted to ask, what do you think queer people in the community can do today to fight for climate justice?
I think there's so many different things that we can do, but I think that bringing in our like own particular perspective, I think, is so important. I think sometimes the reason why there's maybe one type of person in climate or a very small amount of type of people in climate is because those people who are talking about these things to each other, and therefore they bring along similar people. Mm-hmm. And I think if we all bring our own like unique diverse perspectives, then we're going to bring along people within our community who maybe didn't see themselves seen in this space before, or didn't see it as an issue for them beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's so much hope that queerness brings to the climate movement, but to any movement that's trying to change the world, because queerness in itself is kind of refusing to stick within the binary structure or the very like rigid structure that we've been told is the way that we live our lives. And there's a really brilliant quote that I quote in the book that I can't remember who said it in this moment, but by a trans activist who was writing about how like once we start to question kind of the reason why there's such a resistance against transness in particular is because it's if you question gender in that binary, then you're asked to question like, why do we have all these other different structures in this world? Why, like, what? How does money work? How does our government work? How does race work? How do all of these different things work? And when you start to unravel one part, then you start to unravel everything. And that's actually so exciting and inspiring and moving. And I think that it's that kind of audacity to be willing to challenge the kind of rigid structure of this world that I think is what will really transform it. And so that's why I think that those perspectives are so, so important.
That's a great point.
That is a fantastic point. I've never even thought of it like that.
You know, we kind of had that come up in another interview of like, what, there are no binaries, you know, like they put this thing on gender, like there's these two binaries, but like if you think about everything, like race, class, whatever, like it's, there's spectrums, they're all spectrums, you know, like, experience. Like
you said literally this morning, the only binary there is life and death.
And then I said, and that's not even guaranteed either. I'll be floating around up there.
But I think that's, but it's so true. And I think that there's a chapter within the book on where part of it explores this like this reason why there are is such a focus on binaries and the importance, I think, in us challenging that in every sense of the way, because also this like idea of like there's even good or bad as a binary, that's something that I think upholds a lot of the way the world is right now, because all of us aren't willing to like talk to each other often or challenge each other or have spaces where we can kind of actually like have conversations, because we have this idea that some things are wholly good and some things are wholly bad, and that therefore people are wholly good or wholly bad. And I think that all of that just holds us back from first challenging ourselves as well, because if we don't want to be seen as wholly bad, we're never allowed to change, really, because we're like, right now I must be wholly good, so I can't challenge the part, or I can't even be aware of the parts of myself that might be holding up things that are bad, because you don't want to be put in like the bad camp. But actually all of us are a mix of good and bad and everything in between, and I think that if we move beyond that binary, we can also challenge ourselves as well as challenge others.
That's a hot take.
I think, is it Fred Hampton you quote in the book as well? He did like, I mean, brought all these movements together, right? And like that Rainbow Coalition, which is seeing through like these people are bad and these people are good, and yeah. like seeing a common goal for everyone, which was a big threat and ended up in him being sort of
assassinated. Yeah. Because, and I think that because there is a huge, the status quo in the ruling class like really does fear you us united, and mm-hmm. like all the people who would benefit from challenging the world as it is uniting together, and so that's why we're pitted against each other, I think, so often. And I just think that forming these kind of coalitional spaces where we can find common ground and work together is of vital importance. And I think that it's like, I think I'm really careful in the book as well, and I'm talking about good, bad, bad news and stuff. It's not that we like erase all accountability or that we don't challenge each other. It's more that we don't kind of have that. It's more that how much, I mean, I'm an abolitionist, so like how much in how we are kind of operating even within movement spaces or in spaces where we're trying to change things, how much are we kind of enforcing ideas of like the prison or prisons within, even in that, in that we have these kind of high barbed wire fences within our movements rather than movements, as Adrian Marie Brown writes about it, as movements instead being like a sanctuary where people who have been harmed and caused harmed are like allowed a space to grow and to change. Because I don't think people realise that if we want to change the world, if we want to have a better world where everyone gets to live in dignity, it's going to require literally billions of people who currently believe certain different things or act in certain ways to be allowed to change those beliefs and those actions. And so we have to have some sort of way that we can challenge each other and hold space for each other and allow for that transformation as well. And I don't think the way that we're going to do that is by just kicking everyone to the curb because they aren't as perfect as we are. Mm-hmm. And even doing that obscures, like, how do we get here? I mean, I did not leap from the womb as this like perfect person who understood everything and was completely unproblematic, and none of us did. Mm-hmm. But I think that because we're often so afraid of being ousted from our community or our spaces, we will like obscure our own journeys or the ways that we've done things not as great in the past, or the ways that we've learned and grown. And I think there's actually so much power in being honest with that journey. Like, I don't know, I have pals who used to be like Raj like Tories when they were much younger, because they grew up really working class and ended up in a YouTube rabbit hole that told them that the reason that they were poor was because of all these other people, and that they should just have these kind of conservative politics, and that's what all. And I think there's, and them being honest with that that's what their journey was, and also honest with how they managed to organize their way out of that space. I think is so powerful.
And
more so than people being like, I've been a perfect lefty my whole life, and I'm like,
okay. So you've not gone through any change, like,
and
you've
also
been gifted like this perspective, like.
Yeah, and I think that there's something to be said about, like, how, I don't know, for example, I think through my life, like, I used to definitely have, like, much weaker politics when I was younger, not understanding things in certain ways, and there are people that maybe believe similar politics. I don't know, I used to be very, like, sustainable lifestyle kind of vibes, and just making different choices and purchases. And I think that I've managed to maybe, like, organise some people who also have those similar politics now, a bit more towards, like, an organising perspective. But I think that all of us, if we're honest with like how we've got where we are now, we can kind of organise people or help people navigate who are maybe where we were before. So it's not that saying that like everyone has to have done terrible things in the or had maybe not as great politics, and that's what I'm saying. But it's more so that like all of us, if we're honest, then we can get people who were at the same place. Mm-hmm. Don't know if I made sense at the end of that.
No, you made totally sense.
That's just been my thoughts recently.
Yeah, and I think like for the LGBT community, there's loads of different opinions, and there's loads of frictions that exist and have always existed, you know, like in how to organize and like that. I was reading about the ACT UP movement, and like they had groups that wanted to go and like, you know, do these huge actions against pharmaceutical companies, and then groups that wanted to be like really peaceful and like on the street, and but they all coexisted, and if they disagreed with the methods that other people were using, it was fine because they all had the same goal. And they allowed people to go in different groups and still all like unite under the name ACT UP, which I was like, that's really cool. Like, we can't, like, Extinction Rebellion, for instance, have made mistakes in the past, right? But that doesn't mean the entirety of anyone who sort of like contributes to that is a problematic person.
Yeah, and I think it's also like, yeah, I think in all of this, it's like, how do we actually like try and challenge each other and challenge these spaces and try and like move more towards what we should be doing. And I think that if we talk to each other and like have conversations and like work together a bit more, I think we're going to be more likely to be able to do it. But on all the stuff that I've just also said, like, We Will Not Cancel Us by Adrienne Marie Brown is like,
such a great book.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a pamphlet basically, because it's really quite short. But it talks about all of these ideas of like transformation and how do we have like actual transformative justice and not just like restorative justice, because we don't want to like restore it back to conditions that were not okay in the first place. And I think that that has given me a lot of like, it challenged me a lot on how I viewed interactions with people, but also movement spaces. And I think it's really important.
I saw that Diva magazine includes you in their powers list for 2023. You posted it on your story.
Yeah.
And for anyone that doesn't know, Diva is a magazine for lesbian and bisexual women. You mentioned it on your Instagram story. Make sure to follow Michaela at Michaela Loach. And that you still feel like a baby queer, and that it was very affirming to be mentioned. I know a few people that are still like finding their queer identity in their sort of like early 20s, and they're finding it quite hard to navigate this new space. What's your experience been like to navigate your new queer life?
I grew up like in a Christian household where I don't, and a Jamaican Christian household, in which it definitely wasn't something that I think I even like thought I could be, if that makes sense. And I'd always think to myself, why do all the boys not like all the girls? They're so pretty and they're amazing. And I didn't really think of what that was. I was just like, oh, I just think girls are really pretty and amazing. And I think it took me like being at uni, actually through climate organising, because most people that I organise with are very openly queer and live wonderfully expansive lives, that I think I was like led to challenge a lot of things in my own life and how I'd view things in a way that I hadn't really even allowed myself to, because of my kind of religious background and upbringing, and because Jamaica is like very homophobic as a country, which is a legacy of colonialism, and not at the fault of Jamaica itself, but from the church, a lot of, and when kind of white religious identity being put upon Jamaicans. And so it only was in the last like 4 years that I, or 3 years, less than that maybe, 4 years, that I've really like been comfortable with myself saying that I'm bisexual, and then coming out to friends and to family, and being very like open with that. And it was quite difficult at the start up, because I think I'd had so much like internalized homophobia because of my upbringing, and I think that it's actually just, it's allowed me to, I think, live a much more comfortable with myself life, if that makes sense, just that knowing who I actually am, and being comfortable with that. But even now I'm like, ooh, saying things I don't want to say about myself. I don't know, it's so weird, but it's because I think it's, that's why I think it, I feel like I am like 4 years old at being, you know, a queer person. So it still feels very, very young and new. But I'm still very proud of myself, even just for like allowing myself to get where I am today. And a book that actually really helped me with a lot of things was Greedy by Jen Winston. I don't know if you've read it. And Notes from a Bisexual Who Always Wants More. And I really enjoyed it, and it made me feel a lot more like comfortable with myself, because I think I saw like my own experiences reflected in a very different way. But I think that and like social media actually has helped me out a lot with feeling more comfortable with myself.
You're a big advocate of that, aren't you?
Yes, I think social media can do so much good and make you feel some part of community.
For queer people especially.
Yeah, especially because...
I mean, it works out for us.
Did you meet through social media?
No, okay. But like the amount of like...
People want it, yeah, you know, that space where they can go online and see sort of representation, queer history, and like just learn about it, learn about their own history, learn about themselves.
Yeah.
It's like there's such a need for it.
I mean, even me and my friend always joke to each other that like we've never had a unique experience in our lives, because TikTok now seems to the algorithm is like, you think you're the only person who like experiences this or thinks this.
Yeah.
Here's 20 videos of people who feel exactly the same. And I think that there's something that's actually really affirming in that, of like, oh, like there are so many different ways to be queer, and there's so many different ways to like be a person. And I think that it's that expansiveness that has made me feel a lot more comfortable. And not just in like my, like with, when it comes to like sexuality, but also with like gender and challenging that a bit more with myself, of I feel like I sound a bit nuts when I try and explain it, but I don't really feel that much like a woman. Uh-huh. But I feel like a black woman, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that white womanhood has excluded me so much throughout my life that I don't really feel, like, mm-hmm. included within that. But I do feel like a girly.
And
I don't know how to explain that, but I'm like, the girlies, yes.
Get it.
But yeah, the girlies do get it. But also even just allowing myself to be like, oh, I can express my gender in so many different ways. Like, I can be like hyper femme, or I can be whatever else. And it doesn't have to, I'm not trying to, I think that weirdly, when I was starting to challenge gender, I almost then was like, oh, I have to fit myself into a different box. Like, if I'm not in this, like, the woman box, then I have to be in another box. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm allowing it to be more of like a, whatever I'm feeling like as I'm there. And I think that that's also just made me feel like a lot more comfortable in life generally, and affirmed a lot of different like ways I'd felt about things. Don't know if any of this makes sense.
No, it's totally. Yeah. I feel pretty much the same as well. Mm-hmm. Like a day-to-day basis, things can change. And you don't have to explain it. If you explain it, then you're explaining it under like the rules of a binary system anyway.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
I mean? So fuck it.
I always say to people, like, there's a girl, sorry, a person, they are a girl, but I just want to, anonymity. Well, you've not
known. They're all going to find out who that girl was.
I had a friend that came out recently, and she kind of like asked me for advice, and I just said, I'm still learning my own sexuality. Like, I've been out for quite a long time, and I don't think you ever, you just explore yourself and always grow.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's such things. I think I thought when I came out, I was like, I have to know exactly who I am, exactly what, and I think that I was grateful that I had loads of pals who are of different like stages in their journeys of exploring this that really like kind of showed me that there's not really like an end point. You don't even need to find an end point of you've got everything mm-hmm. sorted. And then also recently I've been reading this book called The Sex Lives of African Women, and it's mm-hmm. really good. And all the different people in it are like a very different age groups and exploring themselves and who they are. And just about their like sex lives or lack of sex lives of all different sexualities. And I found that also really like comforting mm-hmm. that there were people, I was reading stories of people who are in their like 60s and are still working it out and still trying different things and working out who they are, and all people who'd been very different throughout their lives. And I think that can be really exciting.
Yeah. Mm. And you never get those stories, right, of like, you know, black queer women in their 50s or whatever. Like, what's a story that's ever been told?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I really enjoyed like Girl, Woman, Other by Bernadine Evaristo, because of, I think
brilliant.
That was, and that also I think really helped me in many ways, like work out a lot of things with myself, because it felt like such a humanising mm-hmm. way of like telling those kind of stories and stories that I hadn't really known about before. Like, obviously, like, spoiler, but the one about the mum who's a cleaner and like her with the other, like her relationship with the other like woman cleaner, and like how I thought that one made me sob.
Yeah.
And because it just felt, I was like, oh, these stories do exist and they are out there, and I just want more of them to be told. I think that's
was
what
it
need.
Based on real
stories? I actually don't. I think it might. I think I'm hoping it is.
Yeah, I'm hoping it is.
But I know that there are, like, I don't know, my friend Liv wrote a book recently called Rosewater, which is about there. I mean, this is also a spoiler for that book, but there's also like an older relationship there that's like an older Caribbean relationship of like a lesbian relationship that was really beautiful in that as well. And I know that Liv did a lot of research to base what she was writing about in kind of stories of what's happened, but and within it actually she talked a lot about kind of old like venues that or events that happened that were just for like black queer women in like the 60s and 70s
in London.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that's
where
we need to
get. Yeah.
You're like, I can see the TikTok already.
Do you think there is a correlation between your queerness and the climate movement and how you grew to be who you are?
Yeah, for sure. I think that I like my kind of like queer chosen family definitely came from climate. Like, we all do joke that for some reason everyone that we know in climate is like both queer and neurodiverse, and all of us are like, why are we all in this space together? And what is it that brought us all here? I think maybe it's part of like when you're already challenging something about the world as it exists right now, so you're already deciding to also have the bravery to step out and be like, this is who I actually am, no matter what the world says, perhaps you're more likely to start challenging other parts of the world as well. So to start challenging, like, why is it that
a very few amount of people are making huge amounts of money off a crisis that is impacting billions of people. Yeah. Why is it that the countries that are most impacted are like countries that are not like, with the populations are not racialized as white? Why are all of these things happening? Why is there this injustice here? And I think maybe that's what brings all of us into that space, because we've already started challenging some things in our lives. And I think that also, but also I think that there's like such a joy that comes from that being there, because I think even though there's so much challenging and like seriousness, there's also a lot of like acceptance and community in us all like challenging those things together, and all of us just, I guess, trying to be our true selves in one space. And so I think that often we make out that, I don't know, activism or the climate movement is like very serious and all we talk about is emissions and boring things. But there is also a lot of like community, and I think I've gained the best community of my entire life from being in those spaces for sure. And it's made me realise how much I was just trying to make myself fit into other boxes elsewhere in my life beforehand.
It's really interesting.
It is really interesting. I then also wanted to ask, like, obviously, for those people that aren't in sort of like that community, that don't see themselves as queer, what would your advice be for them? Is it like, is there a space for them in the climate movement?
Why are you looking at me like that?
No, I'm not saying
how
that.
Straight people join the climate movement.
No!
How do they do it?
I know what you mean.
You know what I mean?
I also can really exaggerate and be like, everyone. There are loads. I do know a lot of straight people in these spaces as well. But I think there's one thing, is that there's a role for everyone in all these spaces. And I think that as to what things we've been saying as well before, is that any kind of unique experience is important. Like, all one of us will be geniuses in our own way of our own experience and the things that we know about the world, and in a similar way that TikTok algorithm can make us realize we have no unique experiences, that also shows that there are other people that we can bring along. So I think there's a role for everyone, and that also I think being in community with other people who maybe have different experiences, life experiences than you, can challenge you in a different way and mean that you view the world a bit differently, which is also quite exciting.
It's good for the straight people.
Sorry.
But also I think it's quite nice sometimes to not be doing everything just like, what are the straights allowed? Like, that's never really asked normally. Because I do a lot of media, so I do a lot of like news stuff of commenting on different climate news stories or other news stories. And when I'm doing that, there's this kind of like tactic that we're told to like do, is like you have to really think about who are you actually talking at. Don't just talk to the presenter, but who are you talking at through the screen? And often we're told to like, who's our Marge? So like Marge Simpson is like, you know, the housewife who's in the corner, she's washing up the dishes, she's got the news on in the background, and she's only going to hear like little bits of it. So how can you talk in a way that you're going to talk about things that Marge is going to care about, so like kind of most people in this country are going to care about, and in a way that they're going to understand it as well. And I think the way that you do that, and there's lots of really great work that's happening around this, is not trying to talk down at people of like, even if they have different life experience to you, rather than being like, you should care that like, I don't know, people are experiencing climate breakdown across the world, or you should care that like, I don't know, about racism or whatever it is. I think instead it's much more useful often to actually reach people where they're already at and what do they already care about. And then you can kind of build other stuff on from there. But if you don't, I think often if we're like just shouting down at people or being like, you should care about this thing I care about, it's not really that effective. So that's what I found.
Yeah.
What made you feel welcome in the queer space?
Gonna take some time to think about that.
Nothing.
Nothing. No one. Everyone's horrible.
They're so mean.
Yeah. I think it was just the fact that people. That's a really good question. What did make me feel welcome? I think it was actually just finding people that were similar to me or that looked like me in that sense. I do challenge a lot of like representation politics a lot into some aspects, but I think the reason why I even came out to myself was because one of my like close friends that I organized with was also a person of color and was also kind of working out who they were. They're like a kind of a year ahead of where I was at that point. And I think I'd kind of grown up with like, oh, the hippie white people are queer, but like not our people, which was kind of where I grew up in the context. That was part of like what it was. I think it was just like having a friend who really, really cared and who got it, and who was like very humanizing the way that they talked to me about things, and that we talked to each other and have very open conversations. And then from there, like gaining that kind of confidence intimately, I think means that you then get more confidence outwardly and in going into other spaces.
What advice would you give to little Michaela?
I think I'd say don't be so hard on yourself and don't put so much pressure on yourself. Like I wish I could just be a kid for a bit longer. I think I look back and I think I was, I still am a bit too serious, I think, about life sometimes. But especially when I was younger, I think I thought I had to do everything like perfectly, which means I didn't really allow myself to explore as much as I probably could have about who I was. That means I'm doing a lot more of that exploring as an adult, which is fine. But I wish I'd just be like, oh, things are going to be okay. Yeah. Mm. And you're going to work it out. Just be a kid and just like mess about a bit more.
Yeah. Let it come at the same time.
Yeah. And don't put pressure on everything. Mm. You don't have to sort everything out right now.
Yeah.
It's so funny that at school we're made out to believe that we have to sort everything out when we're like,
oh, it's mad.
17 years old.
Yeah, they teach you some mad shit school.
Yeah. seriously.
And especially now, like kids now, like they have so much pressure on them. There's so much like in school they were like, don't use spray deodorant and turn off the lights and everything will be fine. When I was little, because I'm an old person, but like progressively that just changed completely. And like I think that,
what do you mean by that?
Well, that was like climate change was that, you know, like,
oh yeah,
just antiperspirant sure, deodorant, yeah. And turning off the light was mm-hmm. that
yeah,
be
yeah.
sorted
yeah like, be sorted yeah.
I and then it changed, it shifted really quickly, and I just think those kids must have to put so much pressure on themselves.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, when I was at the primary school I was at last week, a big thing that felt really important for me to say to the kids was, I was like, there are loads of adults who are working on this stuff, and it's I don't want to put the responsibility on all of you, because it is it's really sad how much kids that are like 7 years old are feeling pressured to have to change everything. And even the fact that adults are putting that pressure on kids is very wild, because whilst there is so much that all of us at all ages can do in some way, that responsibility like should be on us as adults to sort this stuff out, and kids should be allowed to be kids and to work out who they are and do whatever they want, without the kind of pressure or feeling like they're not going to have a future in which to do that. Just quite sad.
Can I ask a question? You can also not answer it. Speaking of children, I feel like it's a big narrative in the climate debate now to not have children. Like, people are very much like, I don't want to have children because I don't know what's going to happen to them, and I don't know, and I completely understand that perspective. But I feel like there's problematic like sides to like spouting that quite a lot, like especially if you think about, you know, that in the context of like other countries in the world, and kind of, I mean,
yeah,
I just want to know if you had any thoughts about it.
No, I definitely have many thoughts. But when I did kind of decide to lock on and put myself in a restable position, part of that came from, in that moment, having a lot of fear around like what the future if I had kids would be, and like feeling quite a lot of grief for maybe, I don't know, what life if I did have a child they would have. And I think I've come like a long way since then, because I've met so many incredible parents who do amazing, amazing work, and whose kids are just, yeah, incredible, and who I do. And that gives you, it's not that kids should not be a reason to like fight or to do something. But I think that there's such like a special role that parents have, I think, in these movements, and that they have this kind of connection between generations, which I think is really, really beautiful. But there's so much danger in this spousing this like, oh, no one should have kids kind of thing, or that putting, or when people make out, oh, don't have a kid because it's better for the environment. Because all of that is just rooted in like eugenics and like Malthusian stuff and ecofascism, which I go into quite a bit in the book, because it's very, very dangerous. And when you make the problem more people, like, what's the solution to and often for many people, so many like extremists, the solution has literally been to go and kill people. Like the Christchurch shooter in New Zealand and the Buffalo shooter in New York, both of them targeted like communities of color. Like in Christchurch, they targeted the Muslim community, and in Buffalo, they targeted the Black community. Both of those shooters blamed like overpopulation as the reason why they went and killed a bunch of people.
Wow.
And so that's why I think it is actually quite serious, like when we start making more people the problem. Yeah. Also because that's also factually not the problem. Mm-hmm. The problem is the way in which like lives are lived in the global north and like the level of consumption, not the number of people.
Mm-hmm.
And those are two very different things. And I think that even the people who are often saying that overpopulation is the problem, they don't blame themselves, or the context they live in. They're kind of pointing away at countries that have higher birth rates and saying that that's the problem. But like, as I detail a bit in the book, but Niger is the country with the highest kind of population growth rate. But someone in the UK in one day has created more of a carbon footprint, as much as that's problematic as a term, than someone in Niger in the entire year.
Wow.
So like, wow. It just doesn't match matter. Up yeah. at all. It's not people, it's the way we live our lives. But I think also, I mean, I'm still working out with myself, like, I don't know if I want to have kids. More like a, sounds stressful.
You've got the time. Where are you going to put them?
Yeah. But I wouldn't want it to be that, I feel like you kind of be like, I don't know. It's difficult because I think there is a reality to which, like, if we don't tackle things enough, the future is not going to be the same future that we were kind of promised when we were younger. Mm-hmm. But it also does feel like giving up completely on the future to just decide that we're not worth saving or not worth continuing.
Yeah.
But I think it's really difficult. I know that I think her name is Serene. Does anyone watch Drag Race Canada?
No,
only because she's been a judge on Drag Race Canada twice, but she's an Indigenous activist and she made an incredible film about like her choice to have children and and coming from a community that's experienced like literal genocide and like how choosing to still pass on that culture to their kids is something that they feel is really important. And I think that part of me on like a more personal sense feels that with myself sometimes, because like my ancestors in Jamaica were like enslaved, and even today I feel like the kind of culture, like kind of real Jamaican culture that came from the enslaved populations, and also just the like Black culture as it is either being like warped or molded to be like more compatible with capitalism and kind of taken away from what it actually really means, or just kind of trying to be got rid of completely. And it does feel kind of, it does feel weird, but I think sometimes I'm like, I also do kind of want to honour my like ancestors in like continuing that and teaching that to my child. But maybe that'll be a child that is adopted, because there are many kids in this world that don't have parents. But I think it's something I'm still working out. But I just think, I'm definitely not someone who says to everyone, don't have kids because they're bad. No, definitely not. And Parents of Future is a really brilliant group that does some great work around parents trying to tackle these things. As you can tell, I haven't fully worked this all out.
None of us have.
Yeah.
It's such a good question, because that's... What do you think? I was just thinking then when you were saying, like, I think, like, queer people haven't really been able to have kids.
Yeah,
and most lesbians had children taken away from them, like, until the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, queer people having children is a new thing, basically. Mm. And, like, queer parenting is a new thing.
Mm.
And there is some part of me that kind of wants to, you know, do that for that sake, like, as well, like, to, it's obviously not the same as, like, what's happening to Jamaican people, but, like, you
but
know.
But no, but I think that there is something to be said, that, and also that I'm like, oh, if all of us who care don't have kids, I don't know, I'm like
yeah,
I feel like...
You're gonna be left with...
Yeah.
Jacob Rees-Mogg's had six children or something, right?
Yeah, I know, but that'll be
weird.
That'll be our future, but I just think... I don't know, I just think that it's also, like, it's really sad, and it's also, I think, a bit, like, it feels kind of, like, dangerous to be, like, oh, we should not be, like, having families.
And
especially for people who haven't had that opportunity for so long.
Mm-hmm.
So...
I agree.
Yeah, I don't think we're in that space. And I think that a lot of the time, sometimes people who are saying that, I think never wanted kids anyway, so it's a lot easier to, like, say that. Or the people who are saying that other people shouldn't have kids, they also have loads of kids. I don't know. For example, David Attenborough, national treasure in many ways, does really great stuff around like documentaries, but also pushes like quite questionable eco-fascist ideals around overpopulation. But he has quite a few children himself. So he's telling all these other people far away in the world they shouldn't be allowed what he has been allowed himself. So I think that sometimes you also have to ask, like, who is it that's saying that? I think sometimes it comes from, like, a fear. And with a lot of people I know, it comes from this, like, grief and fear space. But I think that sometimes we can, like, sit with that. But it's a difficult thing to talk about, because I know I have friends who've, like, experienced pregnancy loss and lots of things around that. And so they find a lot of climate space is actually quite like triggering to be in, because of how much people will be saying different things about whether you should or should not have kids. And and it's just like, but I think it's changed a bit since then. This was quite a few years ago, but part of me is like, we've got bigger things to worry. I'm not going to, we've got bigger things to worry about. And I don't want people, I think that it's sad that I've had lots of parents message me on Instagram and say, like, oh, I felt like I can't go into a climate space because I have kids and I'll be judged for having kids. And I think that's just absolutely heart-shattering and shows that the messaging has been not doing its job. This job should be to, like, unite people and bring people into a space and not to make people feel judged for bringing a human into the world, which is such, like, a natural thing to do.
Yeah. That's really making me think things.
Oh, wow.
We don't do that often, do we?
Stop it.
I wanted to ask whether you've, like, sat there and, like, sort of creatively thought about how you want the future to look.
No, I definitely have. There's even actually at the end of the book, I leave, like, half a page before the end where I want people to, like, write in what is this future that you want to look like? Like, how does that look? And I say, like, rip it out and stick it on the wall. And thankfully my editor put in, if this is your copy, because otherwise lots of librarians would be very angry. I was thinking for a long time, like, how do I describe, like, this better future, this, like, transformed world? I think that for me it comes down to, like, a world where all of us get to live in dignity, because I think that dignity kind of encompasses a lot of things, because if you're living in dignity, then you have a safe house and you, like, have water and food and but not just enough to survive, like, you have enough to, like, be comfortable and to be happy. But also in addition to that, it's, like, a world where all of us get to have joy as well. I think that's so important. Often, like, a safe climate future or, like, a world where all of us have enough is kind of described as if it's this world where there's, like, no kind of, we're all carbon copies of each other and we all wear, like, grey jumpsuits and
live in Russia.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we're told is, like, that's what the future is if we have
we don't have capitalism to allow us to express ourselves.
Then we must all live in caves in jumpsuits and caves. And as much as I love a jumpsuit, I think that is not true. And I imagine a future where everyone gets to be themselves, whatever that looks like, and express themselves, however that looks like. But also, every single person is safe and lives in dignity and lives in joy, in a sense that, like, they're not having to spend most of their life working a job you don't want to do, like, they're not having to, not have a community around them. I think community is another thing that I really envision, of, like, people talk to each other. And I think that a big way in which, I think, like, capitalism is this, like, big economic system, but also in the way that it impacts our, like, how we see each other in our brains, it makes us believe that these things that we all need to survive or be happy, like community or, like, connection to each other, are things that we can't actually just have. They're things we have to buy, and we have to, if we're stressed out, then we should get a bath bomb and, like, have a bath as much like a bath bomb. I think that maybe you'd also benefit from talking to people in your community or, like, connecting with people. And I think that there are so many things that we could address that we also really want that don't have to just come from being bought or being commodified. And that actually, if we created a world that centered more on, like, what we need, and what would address those actual needs rather than just kind of growth and money, then we'd actually all be a lot happier and safer. And it's also, it's not just me, like, talking about it. Like, there's so many studies that have mapped out what could that world look like. And it wouldn't require us to kind of go back to the Stone Ages or to cavemen. We just have to kind of go back to consumption levels of the 1950s, but for every person living at that average consumption level, rather than it currently being that 1% of the world consume so much, like own like more wealth than 50% of the world, which is like beyond wild.
Yeah.
Instead of just be more that like everyone gets to be comfortable and safe and no one's kind of feeling this need to get more and more and more because otherwise they'll have nothing at all. It's like actually all of us could like have some sort of security. Mm. But what I really find exciting is Angela Davis in this interview that she did with the New York Times, I think it was the New York Times, said that when she was fighting for this like radical feminist future in the 1980s, like that revolution that she was fighting for, it didn't come and she felt obviously very disappointed at the time. But that now she reflects back and realizes that even that best future that she was envisioning, this like transformed future that she was fighting for, wasn't even as good as it could get because she didn't have an understanding of like trans issues, for example, and like her feminism was very limited in that way. And that's given me that perspective because I'm like, I think she's great. Has made me realize that even the best future that I can envision won't be as good as it can get. And even that future that I'm envisioning, I make sure that when I meet new people or like I learn about a different struggle, that I include that vision into that future and like I include that perspective. And so that it's constantly almost this vision is getting better and better and better. So rather than like limiting what I'm demanding, if anything, it's like expanding over time. And I think that that can be really exciting because it also pushes me to be like, no, demand more and keep asking for more because even the best I can think of isn't as good as it can get. I think that's really pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Angela Davis, she keeps hope, like...
Oh, she's keeping so many of us afloat.
Yeah. And I'm always like, how does she do it? You know, like when you see her in like talks and stuff like that, you're just like... And she's got this like big... When she smiles, smiles, it's like, oh, wow. But for another 5 months.
But I think that I have like looked at her life and been like, how has she managed to keep going for such a long time? And there are so many things that she's talked about, and like self-care has been a really important one in there. And like she talks about how when she was incarcerated, like she like found a book on yoga in prison and started doing yoga in her cell, and that's how she kind of like managed to like find her way out. But also that she's always, I think something that you can notice in the speeches that she gives, she mentions like 50 people in like every speech that she talks about, and it's because she's so connected to like movements and organizing constantly as she goes, and she's also so connected to learning and expanding that knowledge and that understanding, but not just knowing things but like in a practical sense of like being in community with people. I think that that's what's made me realize like that's what's so important, is like how do we stay connected with each other and what we're doing. And I think that it's that kind of community connection and that connection to each other's struggles and realizing how connected we are that will keep us going.
Yeah, beautiful. I think
what star sign are you?
I'm an Aquarius.
Did you actually? No way.
Oh, God, there we go.
Angela Davis is also an Aquarius.
Is she?
I think, unless I'm wrong. I think her birthday is really close to mine. Maybe I'm getting this completely wrong.
When's your birthday?
I'm 16th of February. I'm pretty sure she's... Maybe.
Mine's 15th.
No way.
Yeah, I can tell you're an Aquarius.
How?
Humanitarian. You're so community driven. You're so like...
That's so interesting. See, this is one thing that's made me less welcome in the queer spaces. I do not understand astrology.
It's completely.
I don't think any of us do, actually.
No, but everyone I meet will be like mapping my birth chart as soon as I start talking. I'm like, it's so, I wish I understood.
You really strike me as an Aquarius.
Really? I like. Really people tell me that I give Libra energy. But apparently my moon is Libra.
That's
because of that.
Justice, though, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah,
balance
but,
and stuff.
But I think that this is one thing, on a bit of a side note, but this is why I feel like for me, community is what's so important about all of this work that we're doing. It's all about we do it together and it all comes from each other. And that's what makes me feel really, like, very uncomfortable with the, like, public figure side of the work that I do. And more recently I've been, like, maybe wanting to move more away from it because... I think that we can use like the individualism that our world has as like a tool to fight this off. But I think I've realized more and more, more recently, how much maybe it's like being a bit counterintuitive to what we're going for because of how much people will be like, oh, you're amazing and you do all this stuff. And I'm like, I'm not really doing that much. In comparison to maybe some of the communities that I talk to who we don't know their names of.
Tell us about a time that you felt pride.
I think I don't let myself feel pride often because I'm really like trying to always check my ego all the time, which I think is really important. But I almost can do that too much that I then like don't allow myself to recognize the things I've done or the achievements I've had. But I definitely think when I first like held my little book baby in my hands, this was like a moment of a lot of pride because I normally do things with other people, as I've said, and things in community, but this was a long 2 years of me sitting on my own and having many conversations as well, but having to try and write something that I felt a lot of responsibility over to present in the right way and to do the best job of. And so definitely, like, when I first held it in my hands, I had a lot of pride. And then also now being able to hear from so many people who've joined movements because of it, like, and hearing people say really lovely things about the impact it's had on their life has made me, yeah, for sure. And I think it's had a really, really big impact. And weirdly, like, more impactful maybe than some of the other, like, wins that we see, because it feels quite personal and something that I managed to do, so I'm very proud of that.
What triggered the book writing?
It came from realising that there's a misrepresentation of the climate movement or of what the climate struggle is, as if it's just about preserving this world as it is now, as in, like, the best that we can hope for is this world with all its inbuilt inequality continuing, and that's what we see as success, or that the climate movement is just about, like, saving penguins and polar bears, when actually, and especially, like, within the climate justice movement and within a lot of climate spaces, there is a big understanding of that climate justice is this principle that sees that we can transform the world and make one better. And I think that is such a great motivating factor for so many people. But that I have found that often a lot of climate books that are facing at, like, the general public and not just, like, within the movement are kind of like, we're all fucked for, like, 500 pages. And very into the science. Or a lot of them are written by, like, old white dudes whose perspective of, like, this different world or this is kind of like, oh, let's just go back to how everything was untouched before we arrived on the land that no one had discovered, which I'm like, people were kind of there, you know? and maybe we don't want to just, like, revert back to that, and maybe we could have something different instead. I wanted to write something that would kind of get climate justice out there in an accessible and engaging way that I feel like hasn't been done to, like, in the mainstream audience in the same way before, and that also would make people who are like me, in the sense that I was born in Jamaica but grew up in the UK and, like, have always been racialized as a black person in this country, and therefore for such a long time didn't think the climate movement was for me because I thought it was just for white people, I want to also engage, like, my community to be like, this is for us, and it actually, we, like, as the black community, we have, like, the most to lose, the most to gain from how we tackle this crisis. And that was Fatima Ibrahim from Greenada Rising who first, like, put it that way, and that had a really big impact on, I think, my perspective and my politics, and so I'm hoping that I can have that impact on some other people too.
Beautiful. I think you did. Like, I think reading it, it's really nice how you filter these, like, bits of information through these little stories of things you're just experiencing as you're writing it. It's just a nice way to write something. It's got no pretentiousness in it at all. It feels like you're just, oh, I remember this happened, or made me think about this, and that made me think about this, and by the way, there's this. And it's like just a really nice way to, like, move information towards people.
I'm glad, because I think also a lot of really brilliant climate books are just climate justice books are also just, like, pivoting at people who already have an understanding of this, and that therefore I wouldn't be able to give them to, like, my friend who I went to school with, who I had a chat to and, I don't know, met up with much later after school and said that they don't understand any of these things and that they felt like there's not really anything that's really... And then I'm realising that, oh, I don't even know what I'd give them. Like, I think that was a big thing, is realising, oh, I don't know what I could actually offer. And so I think it was Toni Morrison was like, if there's a book that you think should exist but hasn't been written, then you've got to write it. And I think that was how I felt about it. But it also felt like, what's the point of writing a book? You know, the whole world's on fire.
You did it.
Yeah. No, but and then also, like, oh, creating a commodity, and is that, like, a thing that's useful? But I think it was realizing how much books have had an impact on me, and that I think they can have. And there's a very unique thing of spending that much time with someone. Like, I feel like Audre Lorde is one of my best friends, even though we've never been live at the same time. But just because through reading her books, I've spent like tens of hours with her and understanding her perspective.
So nice. Thank you so much for coming in, Michaela. It's been great to talk to you. I hope you've had fun.
I've had a great time. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
I've had a lovely time. Lovely chat.
Make sure you buy the book, guys, and also follow Michaela on all the socials, which is Michaela Loach.
Yes, everywhere.
Everywhere. I hope you've enjoyed it. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.